Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Professor Alex David Rogers, a professor in conservation biology at the Department of Zoology, University of Oxford. His research focuses on the diversity, ecology, conservation and evolution of marine species. Alex is internationally recognised for his expertise in deep sea ecology and human impacts on the oceans. Professor Alex David Rogers, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you very much, Helen, and thanks for inviting me to talk to you.
Oh, well, thanks for being here. I think it's such an important issue. Now, you were quoted as saying, and I'm just trying to find this extraordinary quote of yours as I'm looking for it, "If the ocean goes down, it's game over." Would you like to clarify for the audience what exactly you mean by that, Alex?
Yeah, well, the IPSO program, International Program on the State of the Ocean, really was started because I very much felt, and a number of other people felt, that the oceans weren't really being looked at in a holistic fashion. In other words, we were looking at individual stressors on the oceans, but we weren't looking at the effect of all of those stressors together. And when we started to do that, we realized that the oceans are, in fact, really a critical component of the Earth system.
Yeah.
So they're incredibly important simply in terms of supporting life on planet Earth. And this is really where this idea that, you know, if the oceans do change dramatically, then that has much wider repercussions for everything else on the planet, including us.
Okay, so when did you initiate this holistic study on the oceans, Alex?
Well, we initiated the program, the start of the program was in about 2006.
Okay,
it's
been going
5 years.
5 years. All right, now, you still haven't described to us how the oceans are so imperative for life on the planet.
Well, there are the really obvious things, such as the ocean's role in supplying us with food. Obviously, fish are an important source of protein for humankind, but particularly for people from developing countries. So there's a food security role, if you like, that the oceans have. But there are many other aspects of the ocean's role in the Earth's ecology that perhaps people don't realise. So, for example, the microscopic plants in the surface of the ocean supply about half of the oxygen that we breathe.
That's the plankton?
Yeah, that's the phytoplankton.
Phytoplankton, they're little plant organisms that suck in the CO2 and through photosynthesis provide the oxygen.
That's correct, and they also provide the basis of most of the primary production in the ocean. So it's that process which really ends up as fish on our plates as well.
So they're the base of the pyramid of the food chain in the ocean. And how much oxygen do they provide, Alex, for the atmosphere?
It's somewhere just below half.
About
so you could almost imagine it as one out of every two breaths we take.
Really?
Essentially comes from the ocean.
Really? Okay. Go on.
Well, there are many other things as well. So the ocean plays a major role in most of the nutrient cycles on the planet. It is one of the major major players in terms of the hydrological cycle. The oceans also move heat around the planet, so they actually maintain various parts of the world at the temperatures that obviously we're used to. This is particularly beneficial for us over here in the UK, because of course we benefit from the warm Gulf Stream, which impinges on our western shores and keeps the UK relatively warm compared to countries at similar latitudes on the western side of the Atlantic.
Mm.
So if you take all of these things together, it really means that the oceans have this you know, really major role in terms of just maintaining life on the planet.
And what percentage of the surface of the planet do the oceans inhabit?
It's about 70%.
70%. Wow.
Yeah.
And does that include the Arctic and the Antarctic?
Yes, it does. Mm. But that figure actually is a bit misleading, because of course the oceans are in three dimensions, not just two. Mm. The oceans have a mean depth of about 3,800 meters. So in fact, they make up about 90% of the living volume on planet Earth.
Well, what's 3,900 meters then in terms of feet or yards or miles for the American population?
Oh gosh. It must be somewhere in the region of 10 to 12,000 feet.
10 to 12,000 feet, and there are 5,000 feet in a mile. So about 2 miles. The oceans average about 2 miles deep. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Go on.
Yes, and they contain about 90% of all living things in terms of the weight of living organisms.
Wow.
So they're tremendously important in terms of life on Earth.
Wow. Okay, well, let's go on then to how they are threatened by human activities, Alex.
Where do you want me to start?
I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? Well, why don't we start with global warming first, eh?
Okay. Well, as I said, the oceans have this tremendously important role in terms of nutrient cycles on planet Earth, and that includes the carbon cycle. So the oceans have been doing actually a great service to us in terms of absorbing quite a large proportion of the carbon dioxide that we're producing.
How much do they absorb?
About one-third.
One-third of the CO2 in the atmosphere is absorbed by the oceans and turned into what? Carbonic acid?
Yes, that's exactly right. It gets converted into carbonic acid, and this is actually lowering the pH of the oceans globally. This process is called ocean acidification.
Yeah.
And one of the really serious impacts of this acidification process is that it alters the carbonate chemistry of seawater.
Now, explain that to the audience. What does the carbonate process of the ocean mean?
Well, off Australia and many other tropical countries, you have these amazing tropical coral reefs.
Mm.
And in fact, the reef structure is mainly made up of calcium carbonate that's been secreted not just by corals, but also by other organisms as well, including red algae and various other creatures. That calcium carbonate is actually extracted from seawater, and this acidification process is lowering the concentration of calcium carbonate in seawater, making it more difficult for those organisms to actually extract that carbonate and secrete it in their skeletons.
How do organisms, what's the chemistry of the extraction of calcium carbonate or from the oceans, Alex. Can you explain that? To turn it into coral and shells?
Yeah, it's the actual way that the organisms do it is extremely complicated, and it's not actually fully understood at present. But essentially, the organisms extract that carbonate from seawater, which in many regions of the world is actually super saturated with calcium carbonate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they then concentrate that calcium carbonate and build it into basically structural materials. So that could be the shell of a mollusk, the very fine shell of a marine phytoplankton cell, or matrix of a calcareous algae.
So the calcium carbonate that is rich in the sea, I suppose the calcium comes from sandstone and the rock and the sand in the ocean, and then it combines with the carbonic acid to form calcium carbonate. Would that be right?
Well, the carbonic acid actually reacts with the calcium carbonate and changes it into bicarbonate. That's why it doesn't disappear. It's basically it's just moved into a state where it's not available for organisms to actually take that calcium carbonate up. And obviously we're very concerned about this because it has the potential to impact some really amazing ecosystems like coral reefs, but also basically any organism which uses calcium carbonate to grow a shell or a skeleton is potentially affected by this process. And we're also realizing that the decrease in pH, that is the acidification of seawater, has much wider ramifications for marine life as well. So, for example, it's been discovered that alteration in chemistry affects the way that marine organisms actually sense their environment. So it alters their sense of smell.
Really? Really?
Yes, yeah. And this means that, for example, clownfish may not be able to find their proper habitat to actually live in, for example. So Nemo really can't find his way home in such a situation. And this is one of the really difficult things about this issue, is that it really took the scientific community by surprise. And we're really rushing to play catch-up to try and understand what the ramifications of this acidification process is. One of the other effects of climate change is obviously warming. And that is also having some really strong effects in the oceans right across the globe.
How so?
Well, in the case of coral reefs, we know that sea surface temperatures have caused a new phenomena called mass coral bleaching since the late 1970s. And as the oceans have continued to warm, the frequency of those mass bleaching events has risen.
Does that mean that the higher temperature of the sea causes the mollusks or the polyps in the coral to die? Is that what is happening?
It does. I mean, that's the end result. What it actually does is those high temperatures combined with strong sunlight and calm conditions in the ocean actually cause damage to the symbiotic algae that live in the coral polyp.
And it's the algae that produce the colour.
That's right. They produce the colour, and they also produce most of the energy and nutrients for corals to grow.
Right.
Now, those algae basically become damaged by these high temperatures. They start to produce compounds which are toxic to the corals. The corals themselves are also damaged, coral polyps. And they actually eject these cells from their tissues, and that's why they go from these various shades of green to this bleached white colour.
Oh, dear.
And, of course, if that situation continues, those corals then die.
Now, I read, too, in the report from your organisation that coral reefs are not just beautiful things, but they're a habitat for the most profound sort of living ecosystem in the ocean. Is that correct? And if that's so, Alex Rogers, could you explain how and why?
Well, coral reefs are almost certainly the most diverse ecosystems in the oceans. So they have more species living within them than any other ecosystem found in coastal seas and oceans anywhere else in the world.
Mm.
And the reason for that, well, there are a number of reasons. One is that they're quite ancient ecosystems, so we can trace the origins of coral reefs back to Triassic times.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
That would that be so for the Great Barrier Reef in Australia?
It's not that old, but you're certainly talking about coral reefs, which in themselves are potentially millions of years old.
Oh.
But the actual corals that build coral reefs today have been around certainly for hundreds of millions of years.
Right.
So they're very old ecosystems. So naturally there's been a long period of time for species to accumulate in them. They're also fantastically complex. So just in terms of their structure, they have a very complex three-dimensional structure with many hidey holes and small niches for different animals to occupy. There are various different sub-habitats on reefs. So you have the living coral itself, then dead coral matrix, and coral rubble, and so on and so forth. And all these different sub-habitats are occupied by different species. There are also many interspecies relationships. So I've already spoken about one between the symbiotic algae and the coral polyps.
Mm-hmm.
These algae are called zooxanthellae. But there are many other relationships within coral reefs between species. So you might think of some fairly trivial examples, such as cleaner shrimp or cleaner fish that clean other fish at cleaning stations, for example.
Mm.
So for all these reasons, the diversity of life on coral reefs is amazing. And in fact, we don't really fully understand just how diverse these systems are. And you can see estimates of the diversity of animals and plants on coral reefs is varying between 500,000 to 9 million species potentially associated with these systems.
So coral reefs are a little bit like ancient forests, which have an understory and the top story and everything in between, and the diversity of life, like the ants and the spiders and the insects and the algae and the fungi and everything that make up a forest. Could you compare a little bit the coral reefs to forests?
I think that's actually quite a good analogy. In that forests are also structurally very complex ecosystems with, again, many niches for different species to occupy.
Mm.
And coral reefs certainly seem to have those sorts of attributes.
So,
another analogy is in the very tight recycling of nutrients within those systems, which again are a recipe for a high level of diversity.
What area of the ocean do coral reefs occupy? I mean, they're usually near land, aren't they? Near sort of shallow areas. So what area of the oceans do the coral reefs occupy?
It's actually a tiny area. I mean, we're talking about an area of I can't remember the exact figure now, but it's somewhere around 1%.
Oh, tiny.
Or so of the area of the ocean.
And it's yet,
it's a very...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, very small area, which means it's it makes them particularly important, because we have systems here which occupy only a very small area, but they have overwhelming importance in terms of the diversity that they comprise.
You know, I read years ago when I was writing my book, If You Love This Planet, Alex, that in Indonesia or in Asia somewhere off the coast, the way they fish is to put explosives in the coral reefs that kill the fish, and the fish then float to the surface, and then that's how they fish.
Yeah, that's right. That's called blast fishing, and it's still going on today. And not only is it a tremendously wasteful way to fish, because although many of the small fish float to the surface, a lot of the small fish, their swim bladders are actually ruptured by those underwater explosions. So they actually sink. And, of course, the fishermen miss a lot of those fish that they sink. But also that the effect of that blast is simply to blast the coral reef flat.
Blast it.
So it's tremendously destructive.
Aren't we a destructive species, Alex?
Very destructive, although... I mean, the surprising thing is that we are still destructive, despite the fact that we now understand that destruction that we are causing. And in some cases, we have within our grasp the know-how to actually prevent that destruction. And that was one of the things which really came through from the report that we published, that many of the problems that we face in the oceans are solvable.
But wouldn't you say that is confined to a small group of scientists, such as you are, but has not extrapolated yet to the politicians in general, nor to the general public, nor to the people who are blasting the coral reefs, nor to the fishermen?
I think you are right. To some extent, I think people now are becoming more conscious about the damage that we're doing to the natural ecosystems of the planet. And I think that also there is a realization that this can't be a good thing.
No.
That we recognize that these ecosystems are actually providing us with very important services, such as, you know, providing us oxygen to breathe, or taking up waste that we're producing, or providing us with food. But there is no doubt that, unfortunately, it's very profitable to undertake certain activities which damage the ocean. And really, you can liken this to burning your capital, because what you're actually doing is you're destroying the resource so that it simply can't be used in the future. Whereas if we actually use those resources in a sustainable way, they would be there for us more or less in perpetuity.
I'm interviewing Professor Alex Rogers, the Professor in Conservation Biology at the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford in Britain. I wonder now, Alex, if you could talk about fishing. All the different methods of fishing, like longline fishing, industrial fishing, scraping the bottom of the ocean with sort of drag nets, and sports fishing. Can you just sort of give us a précis of where fishing is at the moment and how destructive that is, Alex?
Well, fishing is beyond a shadow of doubt the main threat to marine life at present. Overfishing is a huge problem in the oceans. Many of our large ocean predators, which actually control the structure of marine ecosystems, have been dramatically reduced in abundance. In many cases, 90% of the biomass of these fish stocks has been already removed. And in some cases, as much as 99.9%.
Good Lord, what are they? Which species are they? You said they're the large species.
Yeah, so these would be large predators like cod, for example.
Cod.
Certain types of tuna, some of the large sharks. Basically, what people typically think of when they often think about the oceans are these what we call apex predators.
And why is their destruction so serious to the rest of the food chain or life in the oceans then?
Well, one of the things we've been discovering is that marine ecosystems, like any ecosystem really, are strongly interconnected between different levels of the food web. And in many cases, these predators actually maintain the structure of the ecosystem. It's something we call top-down control of the structure of an ecosystem. So their presence keeps the abundance of other organisms at a relatively low level. And that ecosystem has evolved over a long period of time to actually develop that structure. So when you remove those predators, what you can find is that you get things like mesopredator release, and this is where the lower level predators in the ecosystem actually suddenly increase in abundance.
Like,
and that can have all sorts of unforeseen consequences at the ecosystem scale.
Like what?
For example, that can make actually getting these over-exploited fish stocks very difficult to recover, because the mesopredators actually then change role with the apex predator and feed on the apex predator's larvae, eggs or juveniles.
Oh,
and
so
that means that the apex predator just can't recover its population.
What are mesopredators? Give examples then, please, Alex, of mesopredators, apart from...
Well, a classic example would be... in the Northwest Atlantic, where the cod stocks were actually driven to collapse by overfishing, there was a sudden increase in the numbers of lobsters and shrimps, for example.
Mm.
Now, in that case, what we had was a shift in fishing from cod to these lower-level predators. In other cases, what you can get is a shift of the fishing effort down the food web, and we actually call this fishing down the food web. And that can lead to an ecosystem which is much less resilient to other pressures that we put on it. And in the very worst cases, we can get a complete collapse of that system and a complete change to a much less productive system, which is actually dominated by organisms which humans find difficult to actually use, but also are not very favourable in terms of a food web that involves predators and so on.
So give us examples of the organisms that predominate when you fish down the food web. What are they?
Well, a good example of this is what happened in the Black Sea, where... first of all, the predators were overfished. Then they moved on to fishing what we call forage fish species. And these are small fish which feed on plankton. This was coupled with what we call eutrophication. Basically, the fertilizers that you pour onto land to help grow crops, a lot of that ends up in the sea. And that causes nutrient enrichment of the ocean. This caused a change in that system, which was really promoted when an invasive jellyfish was introduced to that system. And this was actually a cone jelly that happened to also feed on the larvae of the small fish that the fishermen were fishing. And the result of that was a complete switch in the system, where it became dominated by these cone jellies which utterly destroyed the fishery and made the system much less productive.
Oh, dear.
And we're seeing around the world similar things happening, where the effects of overfishing combined with nutrient runoff from land and probably to some extent to warming as well of the ocean is making those systems much more favourable for these quite primitive gelatinous zooplankton, in other words, jellyfish, which then appear in huge numbers in these systems.
I've read lately, Alex, that some of the beaches in Europe and the Mediterranean, etc., are absolutely covered with, you know, tons of jellyfish.
Yes, that's right. And in some cases, that is probably a result of us shifting these systems towards one which is more favourable to generating these huge swarms of jellyfish. In other cases, that can be a natural phenomena, where you just happen to get favourable conditions for those animals. There might be an onshore wind that blows them onto the beaches and so on. So you can't automatically assume when you see a big stranding of jellyfish that it's because of these impacts we're having.
Mm.
But having said that, there's no doubt that these jellyfish plagues are becoming a more common sight around our oceans, as are another phenomena which are called dead zones. And these are areas where the oxygen is simply getting used up in the water column and everything more or less dies.
Oh, dear. Well, now, I saw a photograph the other day of an Israeli nuclear power plant, and nuclear power plants use about 1 million gallons of water a minute to keep them cool. And there were so many jellyfish being sucked into the intake pipe that they totally, totally blocked the intake pipe.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I'm not sure in that particular case what the origin of those animals are. Mm. But these are the types of problems that we're seeing more and more in coastal seas. Essentially, an alteration of the system that makes it more favourable for undesirable organisms to appear. And those may be jellyfish. They might be toxic marine algae, which actually produce these red tides that you may have heard about.
Yes.
They might be the occurrence of human pathogens, such as Vibrio cholerae, which causes cholera. So there are a whole range of undesirable effects which are occurring as a result of the multiple stresses that we're putting on the oceans, overfishing being one of them.
I'm interviewing Professor Alex Rogers, a professor in conservation biology at the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford. Now, I read also that the Gulf of Mexico is turning into a bit of a dead zone. Is that true? And how is that happening?
Yeah, well, that's happened, again, because of this effect called eutrophication that I mentioned. I mean, essentially, all of that farmland in the southern United States, the production of crops there is being maintained by the use of artificial fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that fertilizer gets washed off the land into rivers. And, of course, the Mississippi is a huge river which pours into the northern Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
That river is basically supplying about a third of the entire supply of nitrates into the Atlantic Ocean. It's all coming in, about one third of that entire input is coming through the Mississippi River. And that's basically, it's fertilizing the ocean in the northern Gulf of Mexico. Now, that might sound like a good thing, but actually it's not, because what happens is you get a huge growth of these microscopic plants called phytoplankton, which we mentioned earlier. Those phytoplankton then die as they sink through the water column, and they get broken down by bacteria. And those bacteria use up all of the oxygen in the water column, and that creates what we call a dead zone. And the northern Gulf of Mexico is one of the biggest dead zones that we know about in the world today.
No life in it.
When that dead zone actually grows seasonally, so it gets worse in the spring and summer.
Mm.
And certainly when it's at its worst, the oxygen levels get so low that everything pretty much dies.
Okay, there. I want to get on to something else in a minute, but I live in a small fishing village on the coast of New South Wales in Australia.
Yeah.
And there are fishing boats that go out, and the continental shelf is very close to the shore here, so we get a lot of big fish. And in fact, Zane Grey, who wrote a lot of cowboy books, used to come here and fish years ago and catch swordfish and marlin and the like. But we have a large number of these huge fishing boats that come in sports fishing. They have huge engines which do, you know, they use about a gallon a minute of petrol to keep them going. So they're spewing out CO2. And then they catch these huge fish and hang them up and have their photographs taken beside them and then throw them into the rubbish tip or back in the sea. And it seems so antithetical to what we should be doing. Have you looked at that particular problem in your research, Alex?
I haven't looked at it specifically, but what I will say is that something like 10 million tons of fish are caught by anglers every year. Now that is a huge biomass of fish. When you think that commercial catches are something in the region of 70 to 80 million tons per year, so actually the leisure industry, if you like, is catching really a very large quantity of fish, and in fact. Anglers can have the same effects on fish stocks as commercial fishing. So they very much need to be managed in a similar way.
I think we should ban them. Commercial fishermen at least are catching fish for food, but these characters tend to catch it for fun. And I think we've got to get to a point where everyone can't be free to do exactly what they want to do when the ecosystems are so threatened. Have you thought about that, Alex?
Well, I have, and my own personal view is, you know, I just wish these people would actually grow up.
Yes.
It seems astounding that we still see almost this big game hunter attitude amongst people. Where they, for whatever feelings of inadequacy they have mm-hmm. to go out and kill these huge game fish. And let's mm-hmm. face it, when they're killing things like large marlin and swordfish and so on, I mean, they really are killing the lions and the tigers
yeah.
of the oceans. And really, their activity should be looked on in the same way as that, but for some reason, because the organism is covered in scales and has fins, people often don't think about them in that way. But they are very much, as I said, apex predators in the ecosystems in which they're found. And to actually simply to kill those animals, to have your photograph taken with them, and then to dump them is just appalling. Now, I'm talking as somebody who came from a family of fishermen on the west coast of Ireland, where, you know, my family very much lived off the sea, and that kind of appalling waste and destruction is just horrible. And in fact, you know, humans really have got to change from being hunter-gatherers in the ocean to actually being custodians of those systems and to manage them in a way which really ensures that they continue to provide these wonderful services to humankind that they've been providing up to now.
Yes, maybe one of your recommendations coming from your committee could be that sports fishermen they need to be banned. Like, where people are not allowed to shoot lions and tigers now, or rhinoceroses, or the like. I mean, maybe we should take them on full frontal and extend the bans to them as well. I think that's very important.
I think that their activity certainly should be looked at in the same way that fishermen's activities, for example, are scrutinised. And yeah. Often, I do get the impression that they do, dare I say, escape the net in
yes.
terms of having that sort of attention placed on their yeah. activities.
Now, from here, Alex, Alex Rogers is a professor in conservation biology at the Department of Zoology, the University of Oxford in Britain. I want to move on to plastics in the ocean and how plastics absorb flame retardants and all sorts of very, very nasty chlorinated chemicals, and what happens to the fish and how the plastics degrade into tiny little particles. And I know that your committee has looked at this. Would you like to give us, please, Alex, a brief overview of plastics in the sea and what it means to the oceanic life?
Yeah, this was one thing which came out of the meeting that really, I think, shocked a lot of us. And that was that we were all used to hearing about chemical pollutants, so things like oil in the sea, and also things like PCBs and pesticides and so on. But it turns out that there's a whole new generation of pollutants which we're producing and which are ending up in the sea. And one of those are plastics. And these plastics are very durable. They're very difficult to degrade and get rid of. So unlike many other chemicals which slowly decay over time, what happens to plastic is it seems to just get ground up into small particles. And those particles are so small, in fact, that small marine animals can actually eat them. And one of the themes of the meeting was to really look at interactions between different human impacts on the oceans. And one of the things that a pollution expert drew attention to was the fact that these plastic particles can absorb other pollutants onto their surfaces, and when they're ingested, therefore organisms are exposed to higher concentrations of those chemicals than they would be normally. One of those chemicals of particular concern are things called flame retardants, and these are a major cause of concern in terms of human health. They're being used in all sorts of applications, electronics. They're often put into furniture and so on and so forth.
And on children's night clothes?
Potentially on clothing as well. Therefore, they're ending up in things like the dust in your home, and you're exposed to high levels of these things, but also marine animals are exposed to them because they're ending up in the ocean. And they undergo something that we call biomagnification. And that means that as one animal eats another, and another animal eats that, and so on and so forth, up the food web towards the predators at the top, these chemicals become more and more concentrated in the individual animals. And in fact, there was a scientific report of Canada which referred to fireproof killer whales because they have such high concentrations of these flame retardant chemicals in their tissues that the scientists who did the study referred to them as basically, you know, fireproof. Now, these chemicals are very insidious in terms of their effects. They don't necessarily kill the organism that's absorbed them, but what they can do is mimic the natural hormones in the bodies of these animals. So they have effects on the ability of animals to actually reproduce, and they also affect the development of animals as well. And indeed, there is a suggestion in the scientific literature that these chemicals also affect human development So these are a cause of really major concern. Another group of chemicals that attention was drawn to were what's called artificial musks. And these are chemicals which perfume household products. So they're in things like washing powder, they might be in your shower gel, and so on and so forth. And of course, what people don't realise is that all this stuff goes down the plug hole and eventually it ends up in the ocean. So we're now seeing those chemicals and also pharmaceuticals and various other things such as caffeine ending up in the ocean and being detectable in the ocean, and in some cases actually being taken up by marine life and affecting those organisms as well.
So these what are the names of the flame retardant chemical? What is the name of that, Alex? I don't think people realise how ubiquitous these things are and how the chemical companies don't tell us what they're doing.
Yes, they really are. They really are quite insidious things. They're actually called polybrominated diphenyl ethers. That's a bit of a mouthful. But you will often see the acronym PBDE, which is used to indicate those chemicals.
Yes. And what they do, just to interrupt, is they're estrogen mimickers, and estrogen is a female hormone, so that when they get into the developing fetus, they tend to inhibit the production or counteract the production of testosterone. So a male baby genetically may be born with indeterminate genitalia, hypospadias when the penis doesn't fuse properly, or the testicles don't descend and the like. And then this happens too in animals like the alligators in the Everglades in Florida, where they're so deformed now that the males can't reproduce.
Yeah, and I mean, we first became aware of these, we call these chemicals endocrine disruptors.
Mm.
And we first saw the effects of them in the seas around Britain with a substance called tributyl tin that was being painted onto the hulls of vessels, mainly pleasure craft, actually, as an anti-fouling paint. Mm. And that chemical actually caused the female whelks, these are small predatory snails, to grow penises, which...
Really?
Sounds quite strange, but what it actually does is it completely blocks the reproductive tract of the female animals, and the populations of these animals just disappeared from many parts of the coast as a result of this chemical. So although these chemicals don't necessarily kill, what they do is they make populations unviable, and they can have really profound effects on populations of marine life. And as you say, there's real cause for concern here in terms of human health as well. And, you know, again, people should really think very carefully about what they're actually using in the household every day, what they're actually applying to their own bodies in terms of, you know, perfume, cleaning fluids, and so on and so forth. People should really start to ask questions about what are these substances which are mentioned in the ingredients, what are their potential health effects, and so on and so forth. Because, as you know, there are a number of endocrine-related problems which appear to be growing in prevalence amongst human populations, particularly in the Western world.
Yes, well, there are two things to look at here. One is because of biomagnification in the food chain. If you're going to eat fish that have biomagnified these chemicals, you're going to be in even greater danger than being in contact with the chemicals in your household, number one. But number two, Alex, I think a very important question to ask by biologists and scientists and zoologists like you is, these chemical companies, they make, I mean, there are 80,000 chemicals in common use, only 5 of which are tested per year for carcinogenicity by the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. And the chemical companies in America, I know, and I don't know about Britain, they don't have to prove a substance is dangerous. We have to prove it's dangerous. They can put it on the market with impunity, and we're the ones who have to, when we get our cancers or our babies are born with abnormal genitalia, we have to prove that it's dangerous. Don't you think we as scientists, biologists, physicians, and I'm a pediatrician, need now, Alex, to take on the chemical companies full frontal, because look what they're doing to the planet with absolute impunity.
Yeah, I'm a massive fan of reverse burden of proof. And this applies not just to the pharmaceutical industry and chemical industry, but actually to a whole range of things which impact on the oceans and also impact on us. So in the context of fishing, you know, I believe that there should be a reverse burden of proof to demonstrate from the fishing industry that what they're doing is sustainable, for example.
How would you do that? Would you have court cases and bring the fishermen to court, or would you through your parliament enact laws to make sure that how would you sustain this reverse burden of proof?
Basically, you would make it a condition of getting a license to fish, of essentially undergoing an impact assessment of some form. That basically a part of that assessment includes proving that the activity is sustainable. Now, we do that for many types of industry. So, for example, the oil industry, which I know is you know, treated with great suspicion by many people, but certainly in the UK, oil companies have to submit an environmental impact assessment to demonstrate that their activity has been designed in such a way to cause minimal impacts on the environment. In the same way, I think a chemical company that's putting something in a household product that we're potentially using with great regularity and great frequency should undergo reverse burden of proof. They should be able to prove to the satisfaction of experts that substance is not potentially harmful to the people that it's being used, the people that are actually using that product.
But they're very difficult to experiment with. I mean, to take a chemical and find out if it's carcinogenic, for instance, you need to inject it into rats or mice and follow those mice and rats over a year and see what happens to them. And often the experiments get mucked up, or they're not stringent enough, or it's very expensive. And as there are 80,000 chemicals in common use, we're talking about a major issue, are we not?
It is a major issue, but we are seeing, you know, quite significant increases in certain types of health problems and health issues. Mm. And, you know, I think many people would accept paying extra for those products if they knew that those products had really been looked at in a very careful way and shown to be actually not detrimental to both their health and also the health of the environment.
Mm. The other awful thing about the pollution of the oceans too by these chemicals and by plastic is that the birds, the albatrosses, catch the little fish, which are full of plastic. Sometimes their guts are so impacted with plastic they have intestinal obstruction, and they feed them to their babies so that the baby birds and the albatrosses and everything else are getting full of plastic, which can have a physical effect upon their gut, but also they're imbibing these chemicals.
Yeah, that's true, but we have to look at the relative cause, the causes of mortality those populations of birds, many of which are becoming actually threatened And in fact, the biggest threat to many albatross species is bycatch from certain types of fishing. So, yes, that's a problem, but a much bigger problem is the bycatch of birds such as albatrosses on longline fisheries and also on cable strikes and certain trawl fisheries.
Oh, dear.
It's quite interesting when you do take this holistic and broad approach to looking at impacts on marine systems. It does allow you to really understand where the real major threats are coming from. And in the case of albatrosses, yes, the threat from plastics and rubbish is a significant one.
Mm.
But by far the most significant one is the impact of fishing.
Right. Yeah.
On those populations.
Well, we didn't even get into fishing of whales and all the rest, Alex, and I'm afraid we've run out of time. I have to say to you that your committee and you have such an imperative role, really, the survival of the planet and human species, let alone all the species in the ocean, don't you?
Well, it's certainly, I think, you know, we want to get across several messages, really, and I think a major one is the huge importance of this really wonderful ecosystem we have in terms of the ocean, but the importance of that to us as people. And we may not think about it in those terms, but we really should start to think about really the role of the oceans in supporting the very world that we've evolved in and live in today.
Yes. Well, I thank you very much for this absolutely fascinating interview, Alex, and I wish you the very best of luck and your committee, and anything I can do to help in promoting your cause or educating people, please do let me know.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, Helen. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Professor Alex David Rogers, Professor of Conservation Biology in the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford and Scientific Director of the International Programme on State of the Ocean. And you may have told from his accent, he's actually from an Irish fishing family. The website for Professor Alex David Rogers is www.stateoftheocean.org. Well, thanks for listening today. If you want to look at our previous programs, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, where there actually is a place that you can contribute financially to keeping this program on the air, because it takes money to keep our producers employed and our equipment here going, and I'm sure you appreciate our program. We'll be back with you next week with another fascinating show. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.